and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, and a critical look at our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmanell, I'm your host. Producer Drew Tirico is at the controls. On today's program, grassroots media activism in South Korea. And the right is taking a stab at some things said at the National Conference on Media Reform. We'll hear from Youngjun Kim, who is a media activist from South Korea. He made some comments at the National Conference for Media Reform about globalizing the media reform movement. We'll talk a little bit about some right-wing reactions to the head of the National Newspapers Guild. And we'll also talk a little bit about what the Corporation of Public Broadcasting fracas might mean to the grassroots. Do stay tuned. Each week here at Media Geek, we try to get some news of our media environment that usually gets shunted to the back pages of the business section in our print press and often doesn't get any coverage at all in the electronic press. We think news of media law, media regulation, media lobbying, media mergers, and all that jazz is important to all of us because media is important to our democracy. On May 19th, Comcast and Time Warner spelled out in a filing why the FCC should approve their plan to carve up bankrupt Adelphia Communications. For starters, the two companies said the deal would allow Adelphia subscribers to receive advanced services, such as cable telephone, high-speed internet, and high-definition television. The companies also said the deal will set them up to better compete with regional Bell phone companies by boosting the size of their regional clusters. Individual cable franchises are generally much smaller than phone company service areas. With larger service areas, Comcast and Time Warner say they will be able to roll out voice and internet services that will compete with the phone companies. Consumer and public interest groups are suspicious of the Comcast and Time Warner plan because it would give larger portions of the U.S. cable pie to both companies. A former FCC staff member, Paul Gallant, an analyst with the Stanford Washington Research Group, has published his thoughts on the pending Comcast-Time Warner deal. He said the commission would take between 9 and 12 months to review the deal after weighing concerns about whether Comcast and Time Warner will have too much market power in various markets and whether their high-speed data customers can roam the internet freely. Gallant said it was unlikely that the FCC would impose internet neutrality conditions on the merger, noting that the agency tends to deal with issues like that with broad application in rulemakings rather than during the process of reviewing mergers. Congress, he added, is expected to address this issue in legislation overhauling the Telecommunications Act of 1996, taking pressure off the FCC to pave the way. Gallant said it was expected that the Federal Trade Commission, not the Department of Justice, would review the cable merger. He noted that the FTC is, quote, somewhat more inclined to impose merger conditions than the Justice Department, so the merger's opponents may get a second bite at the apple if the FCC does not impose conditions, end quote.
And at the same time, the FCC is beginning a new rulemaking proceeding that examines the Commission's cable horizontal and vertical ownership limits. The commission intends to take a fresh look at rules that are meant to foster competition and diversity in the video programming market. The proceeding seeks additional comment and empirical evidence to enable the commission to formulate limits on cable ownership, both horizontally in terms of how many of the U.S. households a company reaches, and vertically with respect to a cable operator's co-ownership with program producers and cable networks. The FCC is especially concerned with setting limits that are sufficiently justified to survive court scrutiny. This proceeding follows a 2001 ruling by the D.C. Circuit Court in the case of Time Warner Entertainment Company versus the FCC, which reversed and remanded the Commission's cable horizontal and vertical limits. One issue on the table is addressing the viability of proposals for setting limits suggested by public responses to a 2001 rulemaking proceeding. In a joint statement, Democratic FCC Commissioners Copps and Adelstein expressed disappointment that the Commission never acted on the four-year-old proceeding, and ask that it now become a top priority. A public interest law firm, the Media Access Project, has threatened to take the FCC to court if the sale of Adelphia assets to industry giants Comcast and Time Warner is approved before this new cable limit is imposed. MAP President Andrew Schwartzman said a setting a limit has increased in importance because the pay TV industry is more concentrated than it was in 2001. Schwartzman said he supports new FCC Chairman Kevin Martin's decision to seek a new round of comments on cable ownership because the record generated by the 2001 attempt is stale. Nevertheless, Schwartzman stated that he doubts that Chairman Martin would set a limit low enough to gain the MAP's support for the final product.
And we want to say hello to our new Media Geek affiliate, Flirt FM, in Galway, Ireland. Soon, Media Geek will air on Wednesdays at 12:30 p.m. as part of the station's Kaleidoscope segment, which is kind of a weekly public affairs strip there at 12:30 p.m. Flirt FM in Galway, Ireland, and, you know, we want to serve a sort of a broader audience, so I think you will hear more about Irish and EU and global media regulation issues here on Media Geek. We're always looking to expand, and of course, if you're listening in Ireland, you're listening anywhere in the U.S. or anywhere else in the world on the internet, always you can send us comments, you can also send us stories, suggestions, and ideas, Paul, at MediaGeek.org. We certainly do not want to be only stuck in the U.S. ghetto of communications.
Absolutely not.
And so, Drew, there was someone I saw speak at the National Conference on Media Reform, which was last weekend in St. Louis, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
Linda Foley, who's head of the Newspapers Guild. And apparently this week, some of her comments are making some waves amongst our friends in the right-wing talk boxes.
That's right, Paul. Well, to start off, Bill O'Reilly, of course, has called her comments. He had a whole commentary on it. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to find a transcript, and I don't watch O'Reilly, so I don't know exactly what he said, but I'm sure it was...
We need to go hit the Lexus Nexus is what we need to do.
I'm sure it was inflammatory, to say the least. And our good friends at Sinclair that run the News Central operation out of Baltimore, Maryland, I believe it is, ran a story about it that... that made a comment about what she said was, and we'll play the quote for you here in just a second. What she said was, in a nutshell, that reporters are being targeted, and in Iraq, that is. And let me play that for you first, and then we'll talk about News Central's comments. Here it is, Linda Foley at the National Conference for Media Reform.
Journalists, by the way, are not just being targeted verbally or politically. They're also being targeted for real. In places like Iraq. What outrages me as a representative of journalists is that there's not more outrage about the number and the brutality and the cavalier nature of the U.S. military toward the killing of journalists in Iraq. I think it's just a scandal. And it's not just U.S. journalists either, by the way. They target and kill journalists from other countries, particularly Arab countries, like at news services like Al Jazeera, for example. They actually target them and blow up their studios with impunity. And, you know, this is all part of a culture that it's okay to blame the individual journalists. And it just takes the heat off of these media conglomerates who are actually the heart of the problem.
So that was Linda Foley at the National Conference for Media Reform making some comments about how reporters are being targeted. And News Central said they had difficulty in supporting her, the claims that she made. But, you know, I've heard the story of Al Jazeera's dishes and building being
targeted. That's right. Well, they were in a hotel in Baghdad, which was known to be full of reporters, which was shelled by the U.S. military.
Right. That was the Palestine Hotel.
That's the Palestine Hotel.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's actually, I mean, that particular incident came up several times at the media conference that was had here at the University of Illinois last week. I think Amy Goodman made reference to it, as did Naomi Klein. And this is something which, you know, the incident happened. No one is denying it. The military denies that they were targeted.
Right.
It's
always an accident, of course.
It was always an accident. Never mind Al Jazeera gave them the actual, you know, said, "We're here, please don't shell us," several times. They said, you know, the military denies that they were targeted. And I guess now that's ticking off the right wing. But actually, you know, that was a theme that happened many times at the National Conference of Media Reform, is the notion that reporters who dared to report outside of the embedding of the U.S. military are being targeted in many different ways, be they from the U.S. or be from elsewhere. And I think it's interesting that it, you know, you give it shows you sort of the right wing percolation effect, because I only found out about the brewing controversy today,
right,
which is a week after the our airtime here, which is May 20th. It's only a week after those comments actually were made. So,
right. And O'Reilly made the comments last night, apparently, on his commentary. So, you know, maybe this is the wave is spreading slowly, perhaps from some
right.
think tank buried in Washington.
Exactly, who are trolling for something to get upset about, besides mm-hmm. Bill Moyers, I guess, and trying to get out there. What was interesting about that panel is that Linda Foley spoke on the panel along with the publisher for Seattle Times, and Linda Foley represents labor, mm-hmm. and the publisher of Seattle Times ostensibly represents management, since he publishes a newspaper.
Exactly.
But they actually have nice things to say about each other, since Seattle Times is one of the largest still independently owned newspapers that does not otherwise into other media segments. It's not a TV owner. It doesn't do other things. And the publisher was there to talk a bit about why the Seattle Times has attempted to remain independent, and also spoke about how he felt the quality of journalism is going down in newspapers due to their being owned by chains and having their local news staff gutted and not really focusing on long-term stories or stories of great importance to local people. Now, certainly, I've talked to any media people from Seattle who have their own criticism of the Seattle Times, mm-hmm. But it didn't seem as though he disputed at any point. And I remember in the session, Linda Foley's remarks, as you heard from the applause that happened
right.
there, it didn't seem to be much dissent with her remarks about the targeting of journalists at that session.
I don't think there was much disagreement about that. And in fact, she did allude to that at the end of that statement, that this conglomeration is the problem. You know, and Amy Goodman throughout the conference was referring to these embedded media reporters that, of course, get the kid glove treatment by the military, because they're where they're supposed to be. They're in a green zone. You know, they're being shuttled around by Humvees. Unlike the reporters that have to go out and do real investigative journalism and have rifles pointed at them.
They are not embedded
exactly.
with the U.S. military. Well, moving on to some more interesting analysis from the National Conference on Media Reform. My favorite session I went to, bar none, was a session called Globalizing the Media Reform Movement. It's because I got to hear a perspective very different from what we're commonly hearing in the U.S. And there were representatives from the U.K., from Brazil, from Africa, and from South Korea, telling us some of the fronts that they're fighting on. Brazil talking a bit about how community radio stations are being targeted there by the police. Community radio stations operating mm-hmm. often in poor shanty towns and reaching very dispossessed communities. But the person who was most interesting to me was Myung-Jun Kim, who is a labor media activist from South Korea, who spoke quite well and quite at length about the gains they've made there in South Korea with regard to using media to really help and further the labor movement, which has become fairly militant. And so we have some audio from that session for the National Conference on Media Reform. So this is Myung-Jun Kim.
Yeah, nice to meet you. And I'm from Korea. I'm working in two different organizations. One is Labor News Production, established in 1989, which is video activist organization making educational videos and documentaries about the labor movement, and also training the maybe for past 15 years about thousands of workers to make their own videos in different trade unions, and also have an annual labor film festival where some of the programs of some participants here was screened to the working class audience. And also I'm working in MediAct, which is a media center, which is kind of half institution, half organization. I mean, we are funded by National Film Board, the Film Council, but we have a total authority, autonomous structure of running the center and providing the training courses and facilities and also research and different kind of services to support public access and independent filmmaking and progress in media activism. So those two organizations are where I'm working in. And I will start with small media literacy. That is, many people here, when I met here, that they say, you're from Korea and the workers are very militantly fighting and stuff like that. And many of the images in your mind came from the mainstream media. So it's true that we have a strong tradition of the militant labor movement, but it seems very superficial, because sometimes when you talk about that story, I feel like you say, are these Korean workers are born fighters? Yeah. Right? And are the U.S. workers are born losers? I don't think so. I cannot agree with that. And also, in many senses, there are different aspects we have to think about. The first thing is, we also have a lot of problems. We have similar problems of union bureaucracy. We have problems of the workers not fighting enough. Yeah, we have a lot of problems. And at the same time, we also have some militancy, which you don't have. And that's not just a natural thing. It's based on a lot of activities by the different activists, including, most importantly, media activists. That's the basis of that kind of militancy. So that's not just a natural thing. So we should share this kind of a critical media literacy about the understanding each other. And before this session was organized, I was asked by the moderator that what do you think about the U.S. media activist role on the globe? And I think the answer is very simple. It's very important. It's important in many senses because the labor of the progress in media movement in the United States is very affecting on different levels to different countries. I will give some examples. For example, your important victory, which made possible this kind of conference, the FCC regulation and the fighting back. When FCC announced that plan, it was covered by the major private media in Korea as a top story. They are deregulating this media. And after it failed, they never talk about that. Yeah. So congratulations. Yeah. 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 So this is affecting, on the national level, without regards to big international WTO stuff like that. But it really directly affects other countries. And at the same time, as other participants already mentioned, that the U.S. is playing a very important role to push neoliberalist agenda and destroying a lot of important culture and the broadcasting systems in other countries, which is for public interest. So that's very important. So because of that, I think other social movement in other countries should support you, because you should be responsible for your own movement, not just for this country, but for the whole globe. So you should have a very broad context of media activism, and you should learn from other countries, and you should get the support from other countries to strengthen your movement. That's what I want to say when you ask this question. And as other people already mentioned, many of the international institutions, so I will just move to the Korean cases, because some of the victories we got were possible because of your victories and your gains, although you may not know. So I will talk about some stories and some of the things we have, which you don't have. For the basic media situation is very similar in other countries. Some problems of consolidation and monopoly, but we have some kind of strong public broadcasting structure. So there are some differences and there are some many similarities. And maybe one of the differences is Korea is number one country concerning the broadband internet connection. Everybody has a connection to the broadband, stuff like that. So that gives us some chances and also the problems. And I think that one of the important aspects for our movement is we have a very strong tradition of the alternative and independent media activism, which has a close link with the social movement, especially the labor movement. That was our very good aspect of our history, I think. So past 25 years, there has been a lot of progress on this area of alternative and independent media activism. For example, in the labor movement, there are a lot of internet-related media activists, and also there are hundreds of workers' video collective in the unions who produce the videos. For example, Hyundai Motors Union, you know Hyundai, cars, that union is now one of the most left trade union in Korean labor movement. And now they have three full-time staff who are responsible for the videos for the unions. And one of the things they are doing is, based on the contract with the company, they now have, in that company there is a CCTV system. So when workers go to for lunch, they can see the TV. I don't talk about the surveillance. They have a surveillance system, but I'm talking about TV system. so they see the TVs. So company, they have a production team and they broadcast their program. So union fought back, and after a few years, they got the contract that they can use the TV one day every week. So because of that, they already have a workers' video collective and they were responsible for that program. And so this year, they asked us, the Labor News Production, asked us to make a pilot project for that the lunchtime video. So we are now making the video, which can be maybe imitated or learned by the Workers' Video Collective. That's one of the examples we are doing in that kind of public space in the workers' movement. For past 10 or 5 years, we've been partially successful in the fight on the level of public sphere and public media policy. For example, based on our Media Act experiment, now many of the local media centers are now being established by Broadcasting Commission, Ministry of Culture, by different constituencies, which will support public access and independent filmmaking. And another example is public access. We got the legislation, finally, after many years of fight, we got the legislation in 1999. And that was a neoliberalist law, but that law also included the articles on the public access. So now we have a 30-minute every week on the National Public Broadcaster, the public access program. And also we have a cable access structure. For example, if this month, if you are living in Korea, as a Korean resident, and you make a 25-minute program, and you air through the cable channel, you get $1,000, which is automatic funding money for the cable access. This is very crazy policy, right? Yeah. So this is one of the gains, and it's a problematic at the same time, but it's a very good thing for media activists in local areas to use their resources to strengthen the local media activism.
And that's Myungjoon Kim from Media Act, a media activist from South Korea, speaking at a national conference for media reform at a session called Globalizing the Media Reform Movement. And we want to do a quick follow-up on the Linda Foley story we were talking about just before that talk. We were having trouble pulling up any of the comments about Linda Foley's portion of Linda Foley's talk there, which we heard earlier. And through the glories of the internet, we managed to pull something up. A Newsmax.com story charts that Foley had accused U.S. soldiers of committing atrocities without offering any evidence to back the charge up. And Mark Hyman from Sinclair, who we hear every night at the end of Sinclair news broadcasts in central Illinois and elsewhere, called her comments irresponsible and, quote, horrible allegations, end quote. Several critics immediately compared her criticism up to the case of Eason Jordan, the former CNN executive who resigned after suggesting that the U.S. military may have targeted some journalists in Iraq. Linda Foley actually told editor and publisher, an industry journal, that her words were taken out of context by critics, and her original intent was to discuss how journalists are often scapegoated for their coverage. She told them, quote, this was almost an aside, but it is true that hundreds of journalists were killed around the world, and many have been killed in Iraq. When asked if she believed U.S. troops had targeted journalists in Iraq, she said, quote, I was careful of not saying troops, I said U.S. military. Could I have said it differently? There are 100 different ways of saying this, but I'm not sure they would have appeased the right, end quote. And there it is. It's the right volley there that anytime you question that perhaps the U.S. military may be targeting dissent or that dissent may not be allowed, then you are attacked. Attack the messenger. Don't attack the message. And we want to jump forward to just a little bit of talk about the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, because a lot of hay has been made in the last week, partially propelled by a last-minute sort of not-quite keynote address by Bill Moyers at the National Conference of Media Reform, attacking current moves at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, especially at the board of the community of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, to push things to the right, questioning a supposed liberal bias amongst public broadcasting, brought on by CPB Board Chairman Kenneth Tomlinson, who has appointed ombudsman now to oversee and evaluate the particular political content on CPB, but just yesterday, reading over at the Columbia Journalism Review, it seems like there may be some traction to investigate Tomlinson, because he hired someone named Mary Catherine Andrews, former director of the Office of Global Communications at the White House, to write a set of guidelines for the CPB's two new ombudsmen to use when monitoring political content on CPB. But the problem is that Andrews was still on the staff at the White House when she wrote the rules, which may violate Section 398 of the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967, which bars federal employees from engaging in, quote, direction, supervision, or control over public telecommunications, end quote. In addition, Tomlinson is the chair of the U.S. Broadcasting Board of Governors, the panel that oversees all federally sponsored broadcasting agencies such as Voice of America, also known as the propaganda arm of the United States government.
Yes, it is.
As almost all of the media coverage of the CPB case has failed to mention, in his role at the BBG, Tomlinson himself is a, quote, federal employee, end quote, and he is explicitly trying to direct, shape, mold, and supervise public telecommunications in his role at the CPB, which is an independent independent corporation funded by tax dollars and by the federal communication in part, but not part of the federal government in total. So that's why there's supposed to be this relative iron wall between federal employees. And the whole point was to keep government influence, political influence, out of the corporation of public broadcasting. But one thing Drew and I were discussing before the show, we want to kind of bring up a little bit, is in all this, I mean, it's very clear in a sense, because as we were discussing, Tomlinson and the board handpicked some conservative commentators for PBS to air.
They just picked Kenneth Faree to replace the old executive, the chief executive author.
One of Powell's henchmen from the FCC.
Exactly.
But they also handpicked some programming.
Yes, they
like
did.
Tucker Carlson.
Tucker Carlson, Unfiltered, and the Journal editorial report featuring the editors from the Wall Street Journal, who are not exactly known for their liberal commentary.
No, well, and supposedly to counter the liberal bias. So
exactly.
The only program that he's been able to say has any liberal bias at all is now with Bill Moyers.
And he spent $10,000 on this report. Without the knowledge of the board, he spent $10,000 on this report just to monitor this now with
just
Bill
to
Moyers.
Monitor. I mean, it's not too hard. Just read transcripts.
Yeah,
they're all in that LexisNexis. I think they have a subscription. But regardless of that, it's also interesting to think about. What effects, I mean, this obviously there's a huge effect on public television broadcasting, which relies probably most fundamentally on a CPB because of the huge amount of money involved in public broadcasting, although in many ways, much more of the money almost comes from corporate underwriting than it does from federal funding. But it's also, we should think about what effect it might have on community radio.
Right, because I think most people think of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I think PBS, maybe some NPR, which actually gets very little of its money from the corporation, right?
Well, it gets a fairly substantial amount. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting gives, there's two major areas in which it gives money. It gives program production money,
right?
So, which are direct grants to programs to be produced. And that's where it ostensibly has the most influence. It also gives program acquisition money. And actually, that's what WEFT receives and a lot of other community radio stations receive. And it's a grant to go acquire national programming for air. The CPB has no control over that particular money. It can be spent pretty much as a station sees fit. The grants tend to be significantly smaller than the money that goes to program production grants. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. We'll be back in 1 week with more news and views on our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek on the web at www.mediageek.org. There you can read the Media Geek blog for news that can't fit onto the show, as well as download archive episodes of the program in MP3 in the open source Ogg Vorbis format. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to paul@mediageek.org. I'm host and executive producer Paul Riesmandel. Our producer is Drew Tirico. Media Geek is produced live at community radio station WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some pre-production happens at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. Media Geek is also heard on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and on KQRP in Salida, California. And Media Geek is free to broadcast on your local non-commercial station, too. To inquire, please send email to paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.